Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and Jill Burke of the Alaska Dispatch. Thursday night, around 9 o'clock, the Alaska House of Representatives passed Governor Parnell's oil tax revision bill. Paul, tell us about the scene and the vote.
Well, leading up to it, it's been a constant fight over the past few weeks. Detractors who did not want the bill passed will tell you that it's going to take $8 billion out of the state coffers over the next 5 years, that there's not enough information to vote, that Alaska will suffer for it. Proponents will tell you that, hey, we're losing jobs, we're losing investment, we're losing oil production on the North Slope because provisions of this particular law, ACEs, are so onerous, and the progressivity included in the law is so onerous that they're taking, the oil industry's taking its money elsewhere, North Dakota, Wyoming, South Dakota, other places in the world. And that's where we were with this thing. They got together last night to sort all this out. It's been rancorous, I think, and there's going to be a lot of hurt feelings before it's over, but they in fact did in the House pass it.
Steve, not much of a surprise that it almost passed on party lines, but not quite.
Right. There was one Democrat that crossed and voted with the Republicans. I think there was one or two,
two Republicans
that went over and voted against it. And then there were two members, a Democrat and a Republican, Newman in the Valley and Cisna here in Anchorage, who were excused from the vote. So that's how you got the 22-16. Yeah, so it was pretty much right across party lines. It's interesting to me is that Governor Parnell's message was just as Paul said. You know, he summed up what the supporters say very well. The House seems to have gotten that message. The Senate certainly isn't on board. I mean, there's two different reactions.
Part of the message of Parnell's is there's not enough oil in the pipeline. The pipeline's drying up. It seemed to me they played that tune pretty well. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so too. And there's the layoff factor. We're losing jobs. We're losing jobs to North Dakota. There's the pipeline. You know, you talk to most folks who are close to this industry, and they'll say 5-6 years if there's not more oil found 5-6 years from now, that pipeline could be in dire straits in terms of trying to keep it operating. Now, I'm like Paul. A couple of weeks ago, Paul says he has faith in science and faith in engineers that they can come up with something to heat that oil up and to keep it running through the pipeline. And I'm going to share that optimism with Paul. But right now, as it looks right now, yeah, the oil industry here looks pretty bleak as far as the looking out into the future.
Paul, does Governor Parnell have the personality to impose his will on the Senate?
I'm sorry. I don't know.
Answering the question, but perhaps not as intended.
No. He has ample tools available. Ample tools. He can jawbone them to death. He can talk them to death. He can threaten them. And then he's got the capital budget. Mm-hmm. So when he sits down with the capital budget and sits, you know, a senator down here and says, you know, see that big zero? That's for your district if you don't get on board. That's a pretty powerful tool. He has other things he can do as well. Personality to do it. I think he's committed to this. This is one of those things that 2 years ago he was on the exact opposite side. Mm-hmm. Now he's committed to it. And I think he could. I don't know if he can.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think one of the sticking points is that there have been no guarantees or reinsurances that if this passes, that we will get back that share of oil market that's going to North Dakota and other states outside Alaska. And so how demonstrably did the oil companies make that case, or Parnell make that case?
Well, it was interesting, Steve, that several points in the debate, several House members, Republican House members, pointed out how much higher Alaska's taxes are than in a variety of other places. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to me that nobody stood that on its head, which is to say, those other people are getting had and we're doing it right.
Yeah. But then again, it's hard to argue, too, is when you see this migration going to North Dakota to build up the infrastructure and to drill oil there. So, you know, you you can flip it around on its head that way too. But yeah, you're right. And I can see why this is so.
I was just
confounded.
A little surprised. Yeah.
Right, it is confounding to try and really to sort all of this out. You're right. It's also really tough. A tough sell when you go in. I got a Jeep Wrangler. I went in the gas station. I think it was last night. $60 to fill that baby up. You know, it's $4.05 a gallon. And if you're sitting there as a member of the public and you're going $4.05 a gallon, and I'm supposed to support a tax break for these guys, that's a tough sell right there. And obviously, there's a lot more to it than that. And you can flip that on its head and say, well, if there was more domestic output and we had more production in the United States and in Alaska, that price would come down. So you can. There's two sides, three sides, eight sides. I don't know how many sides of all these arguments.
Let's get Paul back in.
One of the things. The point I wanted to make was, I think Parnell's done a couple of smart things. One is he got the business community together, the governor did, and it was a pretty impressive shot when you looked at some of the video that was shot and some of the pictures taken. The Denaina was pretty well filled up with people who were saying, okay, we want this change. And these are influential business leaders for the most part. So I think the governor was pretty smart handling it that way. And then Paul said, too, you know, that red pen when it comes down to the Capitol budget.
Powerful thing, folks,
I could have built that road, but.
Paul, you were going to say.
North Dakota, the 11.5%. I think our tax going into this was 25% plus the progressivity that keeps ratcheting up as it went along. North Dakota's has got a very convoluted, very complicated oil extraction tax, which is 11.5. That's the highest anywhere in the lower 48 compared to us. I think we lose, and I think we started to lose very big there over the past few months.
Okay, I wanted to jump in here. I watched about 3 hours and 40 minutes of it yesterday from 5-something to almost 9 o'clock and had a clear sense of one thing in particular, and that is that this is very tribal. There's a group of people, mostly Republicans, who very much believe Alaska is endangered. And they have organized and put together an argument and a series of arguments on the theme that Alaska is very much in danger and we have to do something to reduce the taxes. The other group, almost all Democrats, but there were a couple of Republicans, made the point that the only thing certain about this is we're going to lose about $10 billion, or maybe it's $8 to $10 billion. And so they repeated that many, many times, the idea that the fiscal certainty here is that we're about to lose some money, whatever happens with jobs in the future. I think it was interesting to note the Representative Seaton and Representative Osterbeck were the only Republicans to vote against this bill in the House, and they are the representatives of the Senate President Gary Stevens' district. Mm. So you have to believe they reflect their district, and to some degree they probably reflect Stevens' view. It's going to be a big challenge here for the governor to change some minds in the Senate. I mean, Paul's correct that there are ways to do it, and I even wondered at some point if you could talk to somebody about reapportionment. That would have to be done in a special way, but there are ways, but we'll see.
Yeah, Bob Lynn had an interesting comment last night during the debate. He voted for ACES, Alaska's clear and equitable share that was proposed by the Palin administration. Last night he changed his mind and he voted against it. He voted to revise the tax structure. And one of the things that I think maybe gives lawmakers some an out is that they can come back in a couple of years if this isn't working, change it. I mean, that's what they're doing with ACES, or at least the House did with ACES. They feel it's not working.
And then,
right,
of course,
now
they can find out just how hard that is to do.
Yeah.
But while we have you here, Steve, can you explain what is it with three or four members of the Alaska House of Representatives who have shaved their heads? Did you notice the? Do you know about this?
One of them is Sharice Miller. Yeah,
yes.
It started
Chris
around.
Tuck.
Right. Yeah. It started around St. Patrick's Day, and it was some charitable kind of thing, and I heard that Sharice Millett looks pretty good without hair. Some folks have seen her, and then there are some folks who they say should have hair. So that I haven't seen
the Sinead O'Connor.
The Sinead O'Connor.
Yeah. Caucus, okay.
So it was right around St. Patrick's Day that this all happened.
Well,
so
we also know that there's certain kinds of beverages go with St. Patrick's Day, but we won't go there. Jill Burke, a fourth search warrant has been issued in the Fairbanks so-called militia case involving Schaefer Cox and others who have become nationally known through the FBI arrests and investigation and the various threats that they apparently issued. What did we learn from this latest chapter?
This was the last of four search warrants that were sought by the feds when they were going in to not only make the arrests, but try to go into homes, vehicles, trailers, outbuildings, and look for elements of what these alleged crimes are. Basically, having weapons they weren't supposed to have, and two twin murder plots, one affiliated with the militia, the other a separate plot instigated allegedly by this couple who was a member of the militia. But
the Vernons?
The Vernons, Lonnie and Karen Vernon, who had their own beef with a federal judge and an IRS agent stemming from a case that they were facing in federal court over back taxes. So they were angry, they were disgruntled, and according to the indictments, they were ready to take lethal action against the government if the government ruled against them and moved to try to take their property from them. So this most recent search warrant is specific to that case, separate from the militia case, but there's some crossover with the way the weapons were obtained and some similar players. But it, you know, I think the newest thing reveals they at one point were sitting in a car with someone who is now known to be a confidential informant but was not known to them at the time to be an informant, talking about how they were going to execute this triple murder, essentially, of the judge, people related to the judge.
Judge Beislein in Fairbanks.
Judge Beislein. And then also this, I think, yeah, two judges, family members, and the judge. And so they needed three people to help execute this plan. And they were going over their plans to do this, allegedly. The government says that it has audio and video recordings from the confidential informant, and in addition to as many as three informants, maybe more.
Do we have any idea how the government got these informants? And this must have come as quite a shock to Schaefer Cox and his group.
It has to, and the informants are kind of a mystery at this point. We know one of them, according to the government's description, is someone who was very much on the inside, had recently been promoted to an officer within Schaefer Cox's militia. And we know that two of the informants had been in place for at least 10 months and had not been aware of one another. One of them is a prior felon who was facing new felony charges. And so, you know, you roll on the guy who's got something to lose and you learn a lot. And the other one apparently has no criminal record, and we're not sure what their motivation might have been to participate. We do know that both of those identified informants were paid throughout the course of the investigation and that they will continue to be paid according to court records.
And my understanding, I don't know if you heard about this, is that Mr. Cox now has an appointed attorney, Nelson Traverso, who is a veteran public offender.
He does.
Defender, and somebody who's worked for the public defender's office. So if he chooses to accept representation, he will have very good representation.
Yes. Yeah. So, I mean, we'll see.
I guess I was hinting for the possibility that he might demand his rights and defend himself.
He could. He has proven to be predictably unpredictable and not willing to yield to the authority of the existing judicial system.
He's made that clear. He's not a great fan of authority. Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Steve McDonald and Jill Burke. Representative Carl Gatto continues to make waves in Juneau. First, it was his anti-collective bargaining bill. Now it's his Islamic law measure. Paul, what's in the Gatto bill and what happened?
It basically says Sharia law, Islamic law. Can't be used in an Alaska court. It'll have no power in the Alaska court. No foreign judicial systems laws will have power in Alaska courts, which I don't think they have now. But to me, it's just one of those. It's an exercise in why. I'm not sure what we're up to here.
Steve, are we really worried that Ninana is going to be taking up Islamic law here?
I don't think so. At least we hadn't been. Maybe we are now. But I don't think so. According to judicial officials who've gotten involved in this debate with in the State Department of Law, there's never been Islamic law used in trials here in Alaska. They
can't think of anything. In fairness to, if I might, to our friend Carl Gatto, he would say that I'm well motivated and I just want to protect our country and protect our citizens. It seems to me the problem he's having is he can't get anybody from the administration or his fellow legislators on board. In some sense, I'm a little surprised he got a hearing for this.
Yeah, and it really sparked quite an emotional debate. He got quite a few comments. I think he's tapping into what's become almost a national movement. There have been a number of states in the lower 48 where they've considered this. Oklahoma, I think, adapted a similar measure, but it was overturned. And Oklahoma was reacting to something that happened in New Jersey. So it was, I think it's a conservative issue. Tea Party followers have been pushing this change in judicial law, and so he's tapping into this national movement. And he came right out and said too that yeah, there are Tea Party leaders in his district that have come to him and said we're concerned about this. So, but we've heard from Islamic groups from across the state of Alaska who've said you know this is nothing more than. I think they've called it pretty much.
I think in some cases nobody even knew they existed until this came up.
Right. Yeah. And there's no evidence that this has ever happened in an Alaska court trial, civil or criminal. And so why do it? And this would probably be one of those things, tapping into some of the social networks, Facebook in particular. There's a number of people who have commented on this as like deal with the things that are really important to Alaska, like this oil tax bill.
Okay. Jill, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals throws out former Representative Pete Kott's conviction. I think a lot of people saw this coming, but tell us more.
This is beginning to become a common refrain in the government's corruption probe into political corruption in Alaska. The Ninth Circuit overturned a ruling by the local U.S. District Court judge that even though there may have been some evidence that wasn't turned over, Pete Kott still received a fair trial. The Ninth Circuit disagreed and felt that evidence which would have included allegations of sexual criminal engagement of a sexual nature with one of the key witnesses involving minors potentially was not brought out at trial, nor was the mental health state of another key witness. And they felt that these would have been important to impeach those witnesses during trial and could have changed the outcome. And there were some other allegations. So the Ninth Circuit said the only way to remedy this is a new trial. What is not known is whether the U.S. attorneys will pursue new trials against Pete Kott and Vic Coring, who also had his conviction set aside.
Among other things, Bill Allen, who's their chief witness, or one of the chief witnesses, is older. I don't know how his health is, but we presume his memory hasn't gotten any better after a few years in jail.
Right, and he has this head injury from an old motorcycle accident, and that was something people thought might be an issue, that he was, susceptible to suggestion, leading by the investigators. And certainly he, at this point, is probably fairly well discredited based on all this new discovery that has come out
in the post-trial periods.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the prosecutors would still, they have those tapes.
They have tapes and they have potentially other witnesses that they could bring in. So there may be other ways for them to get at these same core allegations and retry the cases and feel that they are strong. The defense attorneys have argued all along that the cases were weak and that there was some funny business regarding what evidence was handed over and what evidence was withheld as trial dates approached and the trials unfolded in court. The U.S. attorneys have been fairly silent on whether or not they're going to consider or whether they will retry these cases. They've said it's just under consideration.
Steve,
thoughts? I think if they do decide to retry, they're going to have to start basically from ground zero because the credibility of the federal prosecutors has been severely damaged in all of this. You know, the Stevens case, Kott case, every one of these cases have been overturned in some way.
There's also a new development also this week is that Bruce Weirach, who was early on Pete Kott's co-defendant, they became severed at some point, has sought through his attorney, Doug Pope, for permission to reveal to the Alaska Bar Association evidence that they believe of government attorney misconduct that took place before the grand jury, presumably in support of the Bar Association taking some kind of action if those allegations are founded against those attorneys and their licenses.
And I think we should note, going back to what Steve said, that Bev Masick, Bill Weimer, mm-hmm. Tom Anderson. Anderson was tried, but the ones who pled,
Bobrick.
Bill Bobrick. They may be very much wondering, why did I do it at this point?
Mm-hmm. Right. John Cowdery.
Okay. Yeah. Paul, the Anchorage Assembly approves the 2011-2012 school budget. The vote was 10 to 1. Tell us about this, Paul.
Bill Starr of Eagle River is the only assembly person who voted no on the thing. It's $784 million, approaching a billion. $237 million of that comes from taxpayers in Anchorage. The rest of it, state, federal money. And there's talk, people I think are becoming more aware as this budget reaches towards $1 billion, and that the number of students has not doubled or tripled. There seems to be concern about exactly where the money's going in the school district, how the school district's being managed. I think in the future they'll have more trouble. They limited it this year to a $3 million increase. Last year it was, It was $789 last year. It managed to cut that probably in half because they traded some of the things that the city was paying for. They handed that back to the school district, police and schools, that kind of thing. So it's actually got a $1.1 million increase, which is not a lot.
Steve, I guess we'd have to say that if the assembly was willing to pass it with 10 votes, there is generally a consensus on how we're going to spend money.
Yeah, and part of it, too, is the assembly gave the school district a very narrow scope of instructions. We need you to be here kind of thing. And to Carol Como, school superintendent Carol Como, she crafted the budget with her staff and fit everything right
and
inside.
And generally speaking, is a well-trusted superintendent.
Oh, she's got tons of credibility. Total disclosure here, too. My wife's a teacher, so I'm not buttering up the boss here, but I've got nothing but respect for Carol Como and for what she's done. And I think the assembly feels the exact same way. I think the only thing to give her more credibility is if she was a general in the military. We love generals. If it was General Como someplace, she'd be, my goodness. But she crafted this. There are warning signs up ahead, though. You've got, they've got a budget, a fund, like a sort of a surplus fund that they use, a savings account that they use to help pay for some things. And that some of that money is being used. The school board opted to use more money than Superintendent Como wanted out of that fund. So tapping into that more often in the future, that certainly could deplete that fund.
Okay, well, that's good to know, and that's good that you pointed that out. Thank you. Jill, a polar bear interrupts oil construction, oil development project. How does this is an Alaska story, although it could happen to Canada, I guess. Tell us.
It does. Well, this is Alaska's newest oil producer, Eni, which is headquartered in Italy, but now doing business here in Alaska, is in the process of developing a satellite island away from shore to begin production, hopefully this fall. And they were in the process of bringing equipment onto the island to finish that process by way of an ice road. At some point, once that was underway, an employee noticed this polar bear mother and her cub. Everything shuts down automatically. They have to establish a 1 mile buffer zone for this bear and cub while they figure out what's taking place, how are they doing, and are they going to move on. Call the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, who bring in their biologists and everything. You just kind of wait for the bear to do what the bear does, which is acclimate and then hopefully at some point move on. It turns out that this was not an expected den site. This is one that had kind of taken everyone by surprise, but this bear had apparently burrowed itself into these large gravel, or the snowdrifts that had built up around these large gravel bags or barriers of some sort that are designed to protect the perimeter of the island, and established her den. After a couple of days, she moved on. They followed tracks out for several miles out towards the ice and never saw any doubling back or circling back. 48 hours after their last scene, they get the go-ahead to resume operations. So it's kind of being hailed as an example of how industry is supposed to react when they make these kind of discoveries. And the comment that was made to me is that the oil construction staff did everything right, the biologists did everything right, the bear did what the bear does,
and this is not the old days when somebody said, where's my 30-06?
No, not
Steve
at
McDonald,
all.
Steve McDonald, we've only got this the last weekend before the municipal election. What's it look like as we approach Election Day?
Yeah, things are heating up, and things are getting a little negative, too. I just, on the way over here, heard an ad that dealing with the candidates in West Anchorage, Harriet Drummond and Liz Vasquez. So that's a pretty hotly contested race. The one in Midtown, that one is pretty hot, and the one in East Anchorage is probably the most interesting one, where you've got three pretty well-known candidates, Gutierrez, who's the incumbent, you've got Tremblay, who's a strong challenger, and you've got Bauer, Paul Bauer out there, too, who's well-known.
Steve, if I might, doesn't this seem like it's going to be a turnout election where the various interest groups and parties get their people and see what they can do?
It is. It's all about getting your folks out, and because you're going to see, unfortunately, it's going to be a light turnout. It doesn't have to be. It doesn't, you know, just because it's, people are saying it probably will be, it doesn't mean that it's got to be. People should get out and do their duty and vote. But, yeah, it's all about getting your supporters out to cast a ballot.
Paul, 25 seconds of wisdom.
For in this election?
Yes.
We just need everybody to vote. We had 18% last time.
Oh, you checked? Voters. Is that what it was?
No, it was 18%.
He counted them.
I counted them. I was there and saw all of them. No, it was 18%, I think, of all the
And that 18%
voters.
Included you.
It did include
okay.
me.
That's a small number. We got
That's
a small number
small.
Of time left on the clock. We're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us in Anchorage Edition. We hope to see you next week right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Anchorage Edition at anchorageedition@kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.